welcome to our third episode of Journey into Excellence, an ongoing monthly series where experts in their field will focus on how the evidence-based promotion of life, liberty, and happiness pursuit requires clear thinking and civility in our family, education, and leadership management systems. My name is Vernon Vohr, and I'll be your host for the next 90 minutes. Our panel of experts consists of Martin Haysacker, Ph.D. Dr. Haysacker is a professor of psychology at the University of Florida. Marty has served as chair of the U of F's Department of Psychology, as well as numerous other boards and communities, and is a highly published author in many scientific journals. Also, we have Brian P. Higley, Ph.D. Dr. Higley is president and CEO of the Building Blocks to Excellence, LLC, a company that focuses on promoting team excellence, personal effectiveness, and work-life satisfaction in individuals, teams, and organizations. Brian has worked with a wide range of organizations, has served as an executive coach to individuals across a variety of industries, and has taught psychology at colleges and universities across the nation. And we also have Jack Malcolm. Jack is the president of Falcon Performance Group, an organization dedicated to improving the professionalism and preparation and productivity of sales professionals in the complex sales environment. In today's episode, Marty, Brian, and Jack will cover the logical fallacies, appeal to emotion, personal incredulity, and appeal to anecdotes, and provide us with specific activities we can engage in to minimize the negative impact of these barriers to happy and healthy families, satisfying and useful educational experiences, and profitable and helpful organization. Who wants to start this off, this Journey into Excellence discussion on how appeals to emotion, personal incredulity, and appeal to anecdotes affect the civility and clear thinking that is so important in our relationships? Anyone? Go ahead, gentlemen.
So, Vern, I thought what I might do is pop in and just ground the listeners again in the big vision of what we're doing, and then we can dig into the fallacies. Does that work for you?
Perfect. Absolutely.
Great. So my career, I think one of the ways that I would summarize it is a journey into excellence, into the three systems that we're focusing on in this series. Those systems are the family system, the education system, and the leadership management system. And I entered into those systems in three different ways. First as a student, then as a teacher slash consultant, and then as a consultant slash teacher to other teachers and consultants. And each time what I was doing my best to do is to look into the degree to which what's happening in all three of these systems seems to align with the scientific literature on learning, change, and growth, and finding very often that there are pretty large gaps between what we know is good for people and what is actually happening very often in these systems. So, Vern, when you asked me to do a radio podcast series, I was really enthusiastic about the idea, and I immediately thought of some of the people that I met in this journey who I thought were working the hardest to actually bridge the gap between what we know is good for people and what we actually do in those systems. And those are the panelists that we have with us today, along with some other people who I might try to invite and get on the panel at some point out into the future. The main objective
Let me jump in here real quick. I didn't introduce John today because he couldn't make it. John is another one of our panelists that's here when he can make it. And John, you know, he's one of the top business thought leaders and leadership development experts in the world. So John Spence. So we don't want to leave him out, folks. If you listen to the series ongoingly, as we hope you will hear John in, you know, at various times. He has things he needs to handle right now in his personal life, but he's part of our group.
Yes, and one of the deals that I made with John, I know he would be popping in and out with us, is when he's not here, that we would do our best to represent his work as well. So we'll probably be referencing John's work and especially his newest book, Awesomely Simple, which I think is an outstanding book as well. So thanks for including him, Vern. So the main objective for me in this series is to invite even more people into the discussions that we on this panel have been having with each other over the years, and in some cases over the decades, on how to bridge the gap between what we know is good for people and what is actually happening in these systems, the family system, the education system, and the leadership management system, and to raise more awareness of how we can use the scientific literature to improve what's happening in the systems so that more people can experience life, liberty, and happiness pursuit in business, in education, and in communities across the nation and the globe. And so I thought before we move forward into reduction of fallacies, it would be good to review how that fits into Journey into Excellence. And I'll just keep going probably every one of these episodes back to Vern's good question in episode one, which is what is excellence? And at least the way that I see it right now is that excellence in its highest form is achieved when activities, goals, and visions are helpful to ourselves and others. And that's why I use the acronym H2O, two O's instead of two H's. Excellence is helpfulness to ourselves and to other people. And one of the people who have influenced me over the years is Jack Malcolm's writings on civility and clear thinking. Jack, as listeners will know, who have listened to previous episodes, is our resident expert in lean communication, also known as concise communication, getting right to the point. And he's done a lot of writing on civility and clear thinking, and I think that's a really nice summary of H2O. So I think about civility and clear thinking being H2O. And another person who's influenced me is John's writings on organizational effectiveness being awesomely simple. So I think where this journey into excellence has taken me and maybe will be taking the listeners is where all of our work overlaps. And I like to say that H2O is civility and clear thinking and civility is awesomely simple. In other words, I believe that a journey into excellence equals a journey into clear thinking and civility. So I think that moves us into where we're going in terms of reduction of logical fallacies, because
Before we move into that, Brian, I just realized something in what you shared. I think it could be really valuable for our audience and the listeners. And listen in the future, if Marty would take a second and Jack would take a second about what it was in your invitation to them to partake in this series that that excited them. What I can tell you is I've known Brian for 10 years on Facebook, and he can be an incredible thorn in certain parts of the body. But we've gone back and forth. I know he's...
Vern means that in a good way, Brian.
Vern, have you been talking to my wife?
No, but I just had an involuntary spasm in my body when you said that. And that's probably too much information.
But during the course of our interactions, Brian and I have kind of kicked this around. And I got involved in AM radio by accident in the 90s, and I started doing some internet radio in around 2010. And I just said, why don't you do it? When are you going to come on the air with me? And in the course of – because he has something to say, something he's excited about. And I finally just said, why aren't we doing it? And that's my passion, because I've been in technology – I went into technology – because I figured that if I didn't go into it, I'd have to probably work like you guys to make enough money to keep my equipment working to make it do what I wanted, and I'd rather not have to spend the time working to keep the technology going. So I learned to do it myself, and that's got its downside. So that's how I got into it. I'm excited about how I can help facilitate or be used or be part of anything that can make a difference like that, and that's how I got involved. And so I think it's interesting. I'm real interested in hearing, Marty, what excited you about doing this, you too, Jack, and then we can get into the fallacies because we'll be talking about those for a long time.
So I got excited about it. The roots of my excitement go way, way back to when Dr. Higley wasn't Dr. Higley. He was a graduate student doing his master's thesis. And I remember reading the introduction of his thesis proposal, where he talked about the notion that people's persistence or stick-to-itiveness, or what is now called grit, and even conscientiousness, which is one of the five factors in the big five factors of personality, that these elements actually are driven by specific psychological states and situations. In other words, that these conditions and situations. In other words, for years we've thought there are sort of people who stick to things and people who don't. We thought the people who are sort of like, you know, winners that accomplish things and people who aren't. And I was captivated even by the introduction of this young man's master's thesis by how psychological, by how perceptive he was about situational components that turn a person at one point in his or her life into somebody who has grit and determination and in a different circumstance, not. And so I was a member of his committee. I followed the data collection. I stayed on for his calls, for his dissertation, which expanded some of these ideas. When I became a department chair, I thought, I need somebody to help guide me to be the most excellent chair I can be to make this department as high performing as I can. And I think Brian Higley is that person. So Brian met with me on a weekly basis for years. So my excitement started way back then. And so basically, if Brian Higley says, hey, consider this, I'm pretty much in. And that's what excited me about this opportunity.
Jack.
Well, just to kind of reprise a little bit of how I got involved in this, John Spence and I have known each other for going now on probably 25 years when he was hired to work for a company that I worked for. And he and I lasted probably about another year and a half with that company and then went out on our own, went our separate ways, but also communicated and collaborated on certain things during that time. So I've known John for a long time, and that's how I got to know Brian. And I've known Brian now, I'm thinking going on about 10 years now, Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, just met Marty as a result of this. But what got me excited about getting involved in this is that I wanted and I still want and I love the opportunity to sharpen my thoughts against other people. And what I mean by that is I do a lot of teaching, I do a lot of reading, and I do a lot of writing in my blog posts. And the type of feedback I get in classes, most people tend to go along with what I say. I get pushback and I get to test out my ideas and I get to refine them, but I don't really get that really sophisticated, if you will, pushback on that. As far as my blogging and my podcast go, sometimes I feel like I'm one of those guys in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence where I'm sending signals out into space and I'm not getting anything back in return. So this is the third one of these that I've done, and the first two I've walked away from saying, that was fun. That was exciting. It was challenging, and I feel like I grew as a result. So that's my selfish reason for being involved in this. Is I want to learn from you guys, and I want to throw some stuff out there. And if you guys disagree, let me know. Maybe I can learn from everybody on this. So that's kind of where I am.
And Jack you know, makes a point that I'm sorry. Jack makes a point that I think is essential to what we're doing on this, which is great minds do not think alike. There will be different perspectives and options, and we may have different lenses on exactly the same sort of core truth, and that makes it all the better.
Yep, and you guys probably have figured out by now I like quotes, and that reminds me of a quote by George Patton. He said, "If everybody's thinking alike, somebody isn't thinking."
Mm, perfect.
That sounds like the world, Jack.
Yeah.
In large measure in many different situations, but that's a whole different topic. You know what? Your whole comment about Brian, Marty, brought to my, his whole – see, Brian is interested in the gap between – this is my phrasing – the gap between what people believe and what the science really tells us. Is that semi-accurate, Brian?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to summarize it. What the scientific literature tells us tends to bring about learning, change, and growth versus what we actually do in our family systems, in our education systems, in our leadership management systems.
Yep.
And what's what struck me about that, that really, and we can launch into the logical fallacies here in a second, but in large measure, that's what that led to the work of Kahneman on the fast flow thinking. He and his partner were interested in the gap between how people thought outcomes would be at a visceral gut level, as I recall, and how things really were. And out of that, they discovered fast. They came up with the models of fast and slow thinking. And I don't know, those just tied together for me for that reason, is that there's that similarity. Is the search leads to things that we wouldn't normally think about looking for, and that's what actually Marty said that in a variety of different ways too. So who wants to launch into logical fallacies?
Well, I thought what I'd do before we launch is to make a comment on what Jack said, the idea of sending signals out into the universe and not getting much back. That is actually one of the reasons why I'm so excited about this podcast series. I have encountered quite a few people on my own little journey into excellence who have said very similar things across the nation, that they're looking for people who take clear thinking and civility really, really seriously, and they cannot find them. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm very excited about this podcast. Marty and I have talked about this as being similar to a sort of radio-free Europe type of a thing where, instead of raising hopes across Europe during World War II, we're instead raising hopes for people who are, like what Jack said, seeking other people who are taking this kind of thinking, the Kahneman-esque thinking, and then translating that into civility and really paying very close attention to doing that in our families, in our education systems, and in our leadership management systems. And we really want to call out to as many Jack Malcolms in the world as we can and let them know that they're not alone. So I think now we can probably launch into the fallacies. And what I thought I would do is just explain at least my view of what the fallacies are and then pitch it on over to Marty to talk about the family system. Marty can maybe pitch it back to me to talk about the education system, and then I'll pitch it on over to Jack to talk about the leadership management system. Does that work for you all?
Works for me.
Works fine for me.
Okay, so here we go. The three fallacies that we have been emailing about in between our sessions, and it's one of the things, by the way, I'll let the listeners into some inside baseball here, is one of the things I look forward to most is our emails between sessions where we sort of figure out where we're going to go based on the previous session. And the three fallacies that came up in our emails were personal incredulity, which basically means if I don't understand it, it must not be good, right, or true. The second fallacy, appeal to emotion, which basically means if it makes me feel bad, it must be bad, not right, or untrue. And then the third fallacy, appeal to anecdotes, which basically means, at least from my perspective, if I tell a compelling story about it, it must be good, right, or true. And with that, I'll toss it on over to Marty. He can add or subtract anything he wants from those definitions and talk a little bit about how these fallacies bring about breakdowns in the family system.
So I think that these three fallacies are ones that are particularly likely to occur and wreak havoc in families. And a couple of these, I think, actually, when we're thinking about families that have young children in them, they can be particularly challenging and difficult. And so I would challenge parents of young children whom they're raising to really embrace this concept and to think about how to parent in ways that may step around it. So let me start with personal incredulity. So in many, many families, and in the family for which I have been the father, I know it is true, I sort of wanted to be able to say, that's ridiculous, or that can't be right, or I don't know about that. And I wanted that to sort of carry the day in my family. And so that my children and even my spouse would just sort of dismiss and move on because I didn't believe it or I didn't understand it or I thought it wasn't any good. And the truth is that's an incredibly convenient way for a more powerful player in a family to move forward, but it's also a destructive process. It's a process that basically says in a subtle way, might makes right. I'm the one who decides what truth is, and that I'm intellectually not humble. I have stepped past the possibility that I might not know everything, that I might not have the facts quite right, that I may be able to learn from the other people in my family. And so I have done it, and I know a number of other parents have done it, and then it's always shocking when you see your children take up the mantle and do the same thing. But this notion of if I don't understand it, it's ridiculous, it's wrong, we're done with it, we're not doing that in this family. I think it's very common, and it does damage. And I think we have to forgive ourselves, those of us who are parents who've engaged in this behavior, in my case, a fairly big amount. But we have to change it. We have to be gentle with ourselves, but hold ourselves accountable. The truth is, if we don't understand it, all that's true is we don't understand it. The truth is our children or our spouse or our other family members or even our friends may really be on top of something that we're not on top of yet, and we've got to keep that in mind. With regard to appeal to emotion, I think this is a particularly I think that appeal to emotion is something that children are particularly vulnerable to. I think all of us are. But children are particularly vulnerable to it because until children are more regularly engaging in intentional, rational, effortful thinking, this is the notion that it feels bad, therefore it's bad, is sort of an automatic, sort of a go-to. And so with very young children, it's the only system available. Then soon, within a few years, other systems are available. But because that sort of showed up first, it gets pride of place. And I think that we have to really work with our young children to introduce them to the idea that something could feel bad but not be bad, or something could feel good and not be good, that those are separable processes, and we need to pay attention to both of them. And then, of course, we need to be appropriate with our children in giving them the level of intellectual engagement that they can handle. I also think that what happens as parents is when we appeal to emotion, when we role model this more primitive system one approach, it can be a setback for children. The truth is children are working and learning about how to be centered and disciplined and to be more cortical and less visceral. And so if we don't role model that in difficult situations, I think an opportunity is really lost. And I think our children come to trust us less when under difficult circumstances we lapse into an appeal to emotion logical fallacy. Before I jump into appeal to anecdotes, anybody want to say anything about these two logical fallacies and families?
I want to jump
Marty,
in because I think
go ahead.
Go ahead. Go
ahead, Vern.
We did in our first show. We talked about false cause, straw man, and ad hominem. And that was the second show actually. Since then, I've been thinking how all these in a way tie into false cause. And when you just made the comment about our kids being less willing to trust us when they grow older and they find out that the appeals to emotion, whatever, our logical fallacies have failed, it makes them distrust us. In a way, being the old man, the oldest one here, I'm intrigued by this because we live in a time or a society, and it's probably always been that way to a certain extent, where the old don't believe that the young have anything worthwhile to say and vice versa, and they're dismissive of each other and as such don't have the power that can come out of the relationships one with another. Older people may have skills to teach. In some cases, they might have wisdom, and young people have youth. So I'm interested in the fact that a lot of these logical fallacies and the ones we're talking about today can lead to false cause, and very much be detrimental. And as you were talking about, Mari, that just resonated to me about all of a sudden when your children no longer trust what you have to say as they grow up and they start to see some of the things that are fallacious in your relying on their emotion to convince them of things.
Absolutely. Jack, you had something you wanted to say?
Yeah, I actually had a question for you, Marty, because you talk about children are particularly prone to the emotion fallacy. At what age does a child develop the actual structures in their brains to allow them to be better regulate their emotions, to be more self-aware, to think more abstractly and think more logically? Isn't there a physiological component to this?
Well, there's a neurological component.
Yeah, I guess that's what I meant.
There is a neurological component, but children are actually starting to develop that process right out of the gate. So
okay.
that brain is remember that cortex is just a massive bundle of connections. And so as children are living experience, of course the primitive brain is activated and running and operating, but that cortex is developing. And so there's no sort of magic moment. And in fact, you can see even really young children develop certain disciplines and certain abilities to sort of take a perspective or engage in what later is clearly cortical, more conscious, intentional thought. So I would avoid saying, you know, when's the magic number by which it occurs. The truth is, it's starting to occur right away.
Okay.
And in fact, one of the things, those of us who've had children and watched them grow up, we can marvel at how even really when they're young, like maybe 12, 18 months, they're puzzling through something and kind of sorting it out and figuring it out. Those are the foundations of system two thinking. They're trying to sort it out and grind it out and figure things out.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and I also think there's wide variability in development in two ways. One, different children arrive at a certain place at different times. And also, there are multi-channels of this kind of more intentional, effortful thinking. And so one child might be really pretty far advanced in one subset of that and not another. And another child maybe be the reciprocal of that. So,
okay.
So we're talking – one of the things when we talk about system two – it's really a group of effortful cognitive processes. It's not just simply sort of one thing. It's easy to say it's one thing because it's in contrast to that sort of automatic processing. I'm not a developmental expert and I'm not a neurologist, but that's my psychologist's understanding of what's going on there. Let me move on and talk a little bit about appeal to anecdotes. And
Marty, before you move on, can I just throw Vygotsky's work out there very quickly?
Fantastic. Good job. Do it. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So Vygotsky basically did a bunch of research on development, and one of the things that he found is that social interaction is really important to the development of cognition. So it just
Absolutely.
Really backs up what Marty was speaking about, that the more we do interface with our children in these sorts of ways, the more likely it is that they'll be able to master that earlier. And that's really part of the reason why I'm so excited about the work that we're all doing here together, is to get this out to more and more people so that they interact with their children in more and more clear thinking and civil ways. So Vygotsky is a good person to look up. And of course, there are many other people who are doing work on this.
And yes. If I could just throw something in on that, and I don't want to take us too much on a sideline, this may be a whole nother episode, but you talk about social interaction being important to cognition, and I would agree with that, but do you think that kids today have a lot less face-to-face social interaction than kids used to have? They don't have the playtime, they have so much screen time, all that other stuff?
Marty, do you want to take that, or do you want me to...
Okay. Yeah, so I have two reactions. The first one is I completely agree with Brian that the literature says the more adults interact in kind of an adult way with young
mm-hmm.
children, the more rapidly they develop system two, the more rapidly they develop cognitive competence. My other reaction, and I do acknowledge that screens are really a different way of engaging the brain, but what I want to say is I think every time there has been a major advance in intellectual technology, the generation that first lived without it tends to think that rack and ruin is going to result as a consequence of that. So
okay. yep.
it could be that with the invention of the printing press, all of those storytellers that had been so so central to society thought, you know, no one will be able to remember a story anymore. They just can read it. This is ridiculous. Chaucer goes down the drain. So So, and you may be absolutely right, but what I have noticed is that that when there is a major advance that changes how we do our thinking and our interacting, the generation that was there before wrings its hands, and society seems to soldier on and move forward nonetheless. So
okay.
I'm a little bit concerned, like the television. I mean, you and I, we're on the cusp of the television. People saying, oh, my gosh, now they're just going to watch the television all the time. They're going to be terrible. And a piece of that was true and a piece of it wasn't.
Yeah, and again, maybe I don't want to get too deep into this, but screen time is one thing. But I think we used to have a lot more unstructured playtime. You hung out with your friends. You learned how to handle teasing. You learned how to handle bullying. You learned how to just get along with a wide variety of people. And
yep.
Your parents didn't even know where you were most of the time.
My
parents
never
knew where I was
care.
Until dinner time. Right? But nowadays, kids are, it seems like they're so structured in their social interactions. I wonder if that may be an issue as well.
And this might be, Jack, a whole other episode. You're right. But,
yeah.
But I think Jonathan Haidt has done quite a bit of work in this area. The idea of free play, sometimes called free range parenting now, the kind of parenting I think we all grew up with. And he does some differentiation between sometimes people will sort of conflate the idea of lots of bullying with free range, because part of what free range and free play is about is being able to come to your own consensus together when there's trouble without some authority doing it for you.
Right.
And sometimes people conflate that with, well, you just think that we should just let kids be abused and bullied forever. But he does a nice job, I think, of differentiating between being able to come to a consensus during troubled times on your own and actual long-term systematic bullying. So the long-term systematic bullying can raise depression and anxiety. But this free-range play, which is the kind of play I think all of us are probably more used to, means that you're able to figure things out without an adult coming in, which gives you the signal that, hey, I can kind of handle the world on my own. And Haidt's doing a lot of associating the inability to think, oh, if things get bad, I can figure it out by myself, with some of the rising rates of depression and anxiety. But again, that probably is a whole other show. I think you're right.
Okay.
You know, and I agree. I think that would be a nice additional show or theme of a show. The other thing is, we don't yet know what the potential benefits are of this more structured life. But I think we're more aware of the. So I think what we've got to do is say, what are the pluses and minuses of each thing, and then. And eventually, I think we want to have data to bear on these various questions, and so we can add that to what we tell parents about might be the optimal ways to parent.
I think I may be a victim of the incredulity fallacy myself in this. So,
yep. So let me shift over to appeal to anecdotes with regard to the family, and I come at this from a background of a father who was the storyteller of our family, remains at 97 years of age the storyteller. You know, go and visit my dad, and we will all be captivated with story upon story. When I was a child, those stories were, of course, meant, sometimes they were just meant to entertain, but when it was stories being told to me directly by my dad, it was meant to convince. And while I think that is a very powerful tool, like many other powerful tools, it has to be used with a great deal of wisdom. So I think there were times when my dad told a very powerful story that convinced me that a thing was true that years later the evidence indicated was not necessarily true. My favorite of which is when my dad knew that I was going into psychology as a career, he just rolled his eyes and said, you know, they're just winners and losers. And so, like, why would you waste your time trying to fix the losers? Just move on. And luckily, by then, I had read a lot of psych science, and I had been involved and in love with the scientific method. And so I was able – I didn't challenge him face-to-face because he was still this big authority figure in my life. But internally, I realized him telling this notion that, you know, no, the world is just comprised of winners and losers, and that's it – doesn't make it true. And that isn't exactly an anecdote. It was such a bare bones thing. But I can tell you he's told many, many stories that you know, I found convincing, and only later had to look at the data to realize, oh, maybe that's true. It's partly true. Whoa, that wasn't true at all. So when I think about my own parenting, I have been much less the storyteller in my family than my dad was in our family. And partly that's because I know how powerful stories are, especially with children. What do we do with children at night? We tell them stories. I mostly wasn't as much a storyteller. And when it was really called for as a parent, I tried to pick things to tell stories about that I thought really represented more or less universal truths. That doesn't make me a great parent. I was suboptimal in many ways as a parent, and still am. But I think on this particular thing, because I was so saturated with these compelling stories that turned out sometimes to be true and sometimes to just be straight out not true, that I became a much more cautious storyteller in my own family. And I certainly have seen in my own childhood and in my children's childhoods the power of stories. And the power of stories to define things. So I vividly remember my older son and I were in a car ride, and he was describing to me, he was about 12 or 13 years old, and he was describing to me the anatomy of a woman's sexual organs. And his description did not jive with what I was certain was true. And so I said to him, nobody, that's not really how that is. And he looked at me and he said, well, so-and-so told me that's how it was. And I realized in that moment, once again, bam, stories are powerful. My friend told me this is what he saw, and that's the way it is. You could tell it was just wrenching for him when his dad is saying, no, that story isn't really the right story. Funny, cute, humorous thing about the power of stories.
I think it's often underappreciated, the power of storytelling, Marty, and based particularly because of this type one, what I call the reflexive thought, because I don't think it's thinking at all. And I think that people that are able, Thomas Sowell says it in a great way. He says some of these so-called thinking people could more accurately be described as articulate people, whose verbal nimbleness evades evidence and logic. And I think it's been that way since the beginning of time with hucksters, snake oil salesmen. And in today's day and age where information is going around the world rapidly, people's ability to take that, alter it, and shape it into partial, incomplete stories, anecdotes, if you really want to call them, really can have a detrimental effect.
That is a perfect segue into the education system. Do you all mind if I use that as a segue into the way
system? As long as you don't tell him that you coached me to say that.
Okay, I'll send the check in the mail later. Okay, so this stuff, you know, Marty talked about, you know, a pretty cute story and people can laugh about it and that sort of a thing. But what I'm actually finding is that although sometimes this can be a cute and laughable thing, is oftentimes this can be a really, truly terrible thing. So what I want to do is run down a scenario that summarizes experiences that I've gathered from other educators, experiences that I've had with myself, although that I've had directly myself as well. So it'll be kind of a conglomerate of what I've been noticing across the country. And I'm again going to talk about student to educator often, but I don't want to limit this to student educator because I've seen this happening administrator to educator, educator to fellow educator, student to fellow student. So this stuff's happening in all kinds of different directions, and I don't want to misrepresent it just by talking about student to educator, but that's where I'll start with this. So I'm just going to go through, I think, a relatively common scenario, at least from the people that I've spoken with, and I've had these sorts of things happen as well. And I'll just kind of talk about the three different fallacies and how they bring about these kinds of scenarios. So At first, I'll talk about personal incredulity, and that again is if I don't immediately understand it, it must not be good, right, and true. And I think this is a particularly interesting issue in education because students, almost by definition, at least philosophically, I think it ought to be this way, they're coming to educators who are supposed to know more than them about certain topics. And what comes to mind immediately with personal incredulity is the Dunning-Kruger effect. And what happens with the Dunning-Kruger effect, we might have talked about this in a previous episode, I can't remember, but basically the Dunning-Kruger effect is that the less we know, the more certain we are, and the more that we study things, we start to realize how complex they are, and so the less certain we become. So this is a really challenging effect because students, the average student, not all of them, but the average student will come into a classroom where they know relatively nothing and are often very certain because they know relatively nothing. And they'll be interacting with an educator who, if they've done their education properly, knows a lot, which makes them less certain than the student. And so they'll start doing whatever they're doing, and very often a more certain but less often well-educated student will say, well, that's not right, that's not the way a classroom should be run, or that's not the way that the world works. And the student might actually become upset if they're confronted by an expert who can give them all kinds of ways in which their certain but uneducated view might not be accurate. And that upsetness moves me to appeal to emotion. And again, that's if it upsets me, if it doesn't make me feel good, it must not be good, right, or true. And so the next step often can be the student ignoring all of the different data that shows them that they are a novice and they ought not be as certain as they are. And instead, they go and might report the educator to an administrator. This person is upsetting me, and so they must necessarily be doing something wrong, when in fact, at least in this scenario, now, I'm not saying there aren't wrong things that happen in classrooms, but in this scenario, what is happening is actually correct, that the more well-educated person is confronting the less well-educated but more certain person with education. So the next step then becomes the possibility of appeal to anecdotes breaking down the education system because the student will possibly go to an administrator. And again, I want to make note that this can happen colleague to colleague, administrator to administrator. If a student happens to know more than an administrator on something, it can happen in that regard as well. But they tell a story about what happened in the classroom that, as Marty pointed out, isn't necessarily accurate. So instead of saying, I'm upset because a more well-educated person confronted my relative ignorance with a bunch of facts, they will relate a story of being not listened to, not respected, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so at the end of this, you have an educator who, at least in this scenario, again, I'm not claiming that all conflict between student and educator is proper and right, but in this scenario it is. So they begin with an educator who's doing what the educator ought to do, which is exposing the problem with being overly certain to the person who doesn't know quite as much. It suddenly becomes a story of being a disregardful or a mean or even in some cases abusive educator that the educator now has to deal with. And going back to some of Jonathan Haidt's work, he has spoken on multiple occasions. Marty and I have talked about this. And Marty, eventually we might want to get into some of your thinking on courage, because courage always comes up when I think about this. But Haidt has mentioned that many times when he's talked to educators, and I believe he's even said that he himself has done this, that because of this fear of personal incredulity leading to appeal to emotion, leading to an anecdote that might get the educator in trouble, that certain educators are just not covering topics because they fear that it might make the more certain but less well-educated upset. And when we start getting into that area, we start really seeing a breakdown in the education system. So maybe I'll just stop there and see if anybody has any thoughts on that.
Jack, you should jump in on this.
Well, I don't really have experience in an academic environment. Been many years since I've had that kind of experience. So I'm familiar with Jonathan Haidt's work. I know he's written a new book. I haven't read the book, but I've read a couple articles by him. And I think I mentioned this in an email that I sent out to you earlier, especially to you, Brian, that I really feel bad for you guys that have to deal with those situations right now.
You know,
yeah, and I think my response was that we should all feel bad about that because, and I think Marty, you responded over your email in a way that I think is correct. Is these are the future leaders of the world, especially as we start to age and become a little more dependent on them. So, appreciate your sympathy, but I'm thinking about all of us because eventually they become our corporate leaders, and then they become the parents to the children that they're going to be raising as well.
So I will tell you something I do in my large enrollment undergraduate class, which would be the place most likely to have these kind of things happen. One of my teaching assistants, who is a person who has already gotten an A in the class or in the prior semester, right as class is starting, covers one logical fallacy per day until we've gone through the entire list of logical fallacies. And what that student does is say, here's the fallacy, here's an example of how it's played out in my life, tell us, class members, if you have an example of how this fallacy has played out in your life or how you've fallen for it or whatever. And so that forms a foundation that everybody has in common because we all share that experience of learning one by one by one all the logical fallacies. Then we shift over and do what I call the logical fallacies when they're applied to your own life, and those are called cognitive distortions. They wreak havoc on our health and our emotional lives and so on. And so then the students have that experience of a highly personal version of the problem of engaging in fallacious thinking and reasoning about your own personal life. And then finally, we're now going through a process of trying to address how to fix and repair distorted thinking that has troubled us or caused us difficulty. The reason I raise that is because we're sort of making a preemptive strike on relying on logical fallacies to decide whether the educational experience you've had is a good one or a bad one. Brian was the one that inspired me to do that. And then the other thing that inspired me is we had a university president years ago who said, you know, the last thing I really pay attention to is what the students think about the class 5 minutes after it was over. What I want to know is what does a teaching expert think about the class when he or she sits through the class and watches what goes on there. And I want to know what the student thinks 10 years later. Mm-hmm. So there are some classes, he said, that I detested when I was an undergraduate. And 10 years later, I find myself returning to the lessons I learned in that class for my life to be effective. And was that a good class or was that a bad class? It was a great class.
And I think something you said there is interesting. If you see somebody engaged in a logical fallacy and you try to explain why it's a logical fallacy, they're going to engage their emotions and they're not going to listen. But if you give them an explanation of those logical fallacies before it comes up and in a neutral situation, they say, yeah, that makes sense. I could see how people could fall for that. And then call it back to their attention when you see them engaging in it. I wonder if that might be a little more powerful or at least a little more palatable to the person engaging in a fallacy.
Absolutely. And that actually, I think Brian and I are probably thinking the same thought, which is in psychotherapy, and in a lot of other domains, but particularly in psychotherapy, providing an insight for a person is a far more fraught and ineffective strategy and setting up a context by which a person can gain insight into himself or herself. And so So what we're always looking for is opportunities for people to go, ooh, I think I just like engage in logical fallacy there. Those are the moments that to me are absolutely golden, whether it's coming out of my mouth or a student's mouth or a teaching assistant's mouth, those moments where you go, oh, wait, I'm relying completely on emotion on this. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'll add to that, one of the things that that I use in both my organizational consulting and in my education is something I call the WATER game scorecard. And eventually I'll talk a little bit more about what the acronym WATER means. But basically it's a scorecard that helps groups and organizations and teams and and I consider all my classes to be learning teams, it helps them to make changes. And one of the 10 components on the Watergate scorecard is self-monitoring. And one of the things that I put out there to both my organizational clients and also to my students is that if somebody catches themselves in an error before I can point it out, that they get some sort of credit for it. So if it's in the organizational sort of realm, I set it up with the leader to say, okay, if someone catches themselves in a fallacy, can we give them something, some kind of recognition, some kind of certificate, something meaningful? And in my classes, if they catch it early, they can earn bonus points for the entire group. So one of the things that I think we condition people in education and in, well, and in family and in business and leadership is we condition people to either cover up or deny some of their mistakes. And so what I try to do is counter condition that. So instead of feeling like they get rewarded for denial of this, they instead get rewarded for actually pointing it out before anybody else wants to point it out. So I think that's another aspect of therapy, education, parenting, and leadership management is this counter conditioning. So instead of having people reinforced to cover these things up, they instead get excited about finding it in themselves because they get some kind of a reward for doing so.
You know, Marty, you said something that really strikes me. I'd like you to expound upon it more, and that is the things that are found that one finds in one's education that are useful and stuck 10 years down the line that you didn't realize were useful at the time because you didn't have the wherewithal to understand that. That seems to be part of the human condition, and we hear it, or I hear it, in the educational system regarding children going through grade school and college. And it's not to say that our educational system doesn't need to adapt to the time, but children and high school students and college students, all of us along the line of life, don't really have the wherewithal to know what we're going to need to know down the line. And we see a lot of movements of, you know, let kids, you know, learn at their own pace, but, you know, what they feel good and all this and that about. And I don't have any problem with that, except for the fact if you didn't learn to read when you're, you know, first, second, third, fourth, fifth grade, it becomes much harder if all of a sudden you find out 20 years down the line you need a reading skill. You follow what I'm saying?
I do. I would put a both and in there. So on the one hand, I think it's really useful to say, here are some tools that history has shown or many people's life experience has shown can serve you well in the future. On the other hand, I think it is also important that we don't ask our children to suspend the system of understanding what is in their best interest simply because somebody in authority says you really should learn calculus or you really should learn the times tables or you really should learn how to drive. I think it is incumbent upon educators to invite students to figure out what is it that they're trying to do in their lives and what are the things that can help them get there so that they become active agents in their own education. The reason that's important is two parts. Number one, it's hard to learn things when you're resisting the things you're learning, and it's easy to resist them when you don't have any idea what the actual importance of it would be. And the second thing is that maybe the most important cognitive muscle we're developing in our children is the capacity for them to figure out what is it that I need to do now and why do I need to do it. And so I would call that a both and, Vern. I do agree with you. You want to lay out and say, hey, these are things that over centuries we've learned benefit children a lot, so really want you to get down and learn these things. And I don't think our job stops there. I think our job starts there.
No, I would agree.
So, Marty,
go one step further, though. Let me finish this one out, Brian. I'll shut up because
absolutely.
The host.
I'm not part of the panel.
But see, at the heart of what you just said is something that I think is very profound and maybe something very powerful about this series, and that is to have trust in the system that's responsible for the education. I post myself as a proud high school dropout on Facebook because to see who's going to try and scam me and send me emails about getting my GED. But I've been fascinated. I was in the educational system up to the age of 35, 37 as a graduate student in chemistry. And there's a certain level of trust that has to be there. I've come to see grade school, and we need. I have no problem changing the methods. I think that students need to be listened to. But what I've come to see the elementary school is part of is it's like going out to Sears and buying a complete toolkit that you might not know what all the tools are for. You don't even know if you're going to use them all. But just the fact that you have them, and if you don't trust the system is telling you or having some knowledge of what's important for you to know only because you're not in a position to know it, and this gets back to parents as well, you start to have very strange things happen, it seems to me, in education. I don't know if I've articulated this very well.
I think that you mentioned trust, and that reminds me of the T in the acronym WATER, which is team buy-in. And a lot of what Marty was saying reminds me of this acronym as well. So I thought what I would do is talk a little bit about this acronym and how this acronym aligns with another one of our aims on this podcast, which is specific activities that people can do if they want to make changes. Would it be all right with you if I walk through some water-centered changes?
Yes.
No.
And by way of back...
are you getting team buy-in on that one?
Then we need that. That's why I asked the question, Jack. I need to get team buy-in before I proceed, or else
I'm
or
okay
going to get in the way.
And let me frame what water is. Water is the components of the organization, whether that organization is a family or a classroom or a corporation or a small business or a military unit or whatever. It's the characteristics of the organization that need to be present in order for the individuals in that organization to be effective and satisfied in their work in that organization.
Well said. So last time I did some STEAM-oriented activities, and I talk about STEAM as bottom-up H2O. There are ways in which any individual can be helpful to themselves and others. And water we often talk about as top-down H2O. These are things that leaders and managers and parents and educators and administrators can do to increase the probability that everyone who is working underneath them will have more STEAM. So here are some water-centered ideas for parents, educators, leaders of any kind to set up their environment to make it more likely that the environment will be helpful for themselves and others. The W in water stands for well-defined, and the A in water stands for aligned. So going back to the mission of creating more clear thinking in order to have more civility, it's important to make clear that the vision of better thinking is out there to the group, whether it be the classroom, the family, or the organization, and that there's the development of aligned activities. That's the A in water. So an example of that could be if you're in a classroom, and this is something that Marty and I do quite often, is we make clear that one of our objectives is to decrease common critical thinking errors or logical fallacies. So that's part of the vision. And then we co-create specific activities. So I mentioned one earlier that my classes can get bonus points on self-monitoring if they point out their own fallacies before I can find them. So just creating activities that are aligned with the vision, and that's the W and A in water. The T in water is team buy-in, and this speaks a little bit, I think, to what both Marty and Vern were speaking about. How do you gain trust? Well, one of the ways in which to gain trust is you feel like your voice has been heard. So what happens a lot in education and in business and families and politics is that the leaders will sort of impose what it is that they think is important, and that really sets the entire system up to be externally motivated. And we know that external motivation only takes people so far. And if people get overly dependent on external motivation, it's actually a recipe for burnout. Eventually people think it's just not worth it anymore. So part of the team buy-in idea actually is related to a lot of the philosophy of democracy. So yes, as the leader in a classroom, I probably do have a lot more information in terms of what we ought to be doing. But because I also know about learning, change, and growth, I know that it's important that every member of the class has the opportunity to provide feedback on what it is that they actually want to do in class. So that's the tea and water. And a lot of what has happened in my classes is students will come up with their own activities, and they'll get real excited about it. Hey, Dr. Higley, I think if I did this or I did that, that this could really help the classroom, and I'm all excited about hearing stuff from them rather than just imposing my own activities on them. The E and the R in water stands for execution and reward, and this speaks, I think, also, Vern, to your idea of trusting the system. I think a system that is trustworthy makes sure that when people execute activities that are aligned with the vision, in this case, catching your own logical fallacies in order to help with the vision of more clear thinking and civility, that there ought to be meaningful rewards. And one of the top things that
Brian, can I
that
jump
a lot of, yeah. Yeah, Bill.
I don't want to be misunderstood on that, because I don't think that our systems need to automatically be trusted just because they're authoritative systems. I'm saying
that
if they're not trusted, that's an area that needs to be worked on, just like parents of children need to interact with. This is just my opinions, guys. I don't have anywhere the knowledge you all do. But children, parents need to instill trust in their children. And it needs to be, they need to give out trustworthy advice for that. I'm saying that I'm not saying children should trust things that are untrustworthy, or that we should trust unworthy systems. But we need, you and I as parents and grandparents and people out in the society, need to hold our institutions to a standard where they are trustworthy, because we need to be able to trust and rely on them in certain areas, just like a pilot flying on instrument flying rules. That's all they got. I mean, their opinion about how they feel flying by the seat of their pants winds up putting them into cumulus granus, or as they used to say, a cloud full of rocks. That's all you got when you're flying instrument flying rules in clouds. If your instruments are not trustworthy, you don't have any hope. And that's what I'm talking about.
And I think that's perfect. That's really what this WATER acronym is all about. It's about the feedback loop between people who trust and people who are trustworthy. And so I'm glad you used the trustworthy thing, and that we have to be a feedback loop.
And I just want
loop.
To be clear on that, because I am not. I came from a generation that says, question everything, and only in later life did I realize that when we said that when we were younger, what we really meant was reject anything anyone has to say to you that you don't agree with, and that's very different than trusting. And I've come to the point in my life that you need to be absolutely need to be discriminating. You need to learn when you can't, when you can't trust. It's good to be wary. My whole notion about that is that the parents need to work with the education system or whatever, because a kid going into first grade doesn't know what they're going to need. I was a smart rat, and I'll shut up in a second here, going through high school because I managed to avoid college prep English. I thought I'd slick on that, and history and things that would be very useful to me these days. And I can still write reasonably well, but I cheated myself. And I know that there's things I've discovered in life that can be useful that someone that's younger won't know until they get to a certain place, And you can talk to young people, if you have brothers and sisters that are just 3 years difference in age, you can talk to the older one and ask them if they know more than their brother or sister, they'll understand that concept.
Well, that ties into the E and the R in water, that execution has to be tied to reward. And part of what we know about intrinsic motivation, which is really the fuel for lifelong learning, which is, I think, the goal of any educator worth his or her soul, in my opinion, is that the learner can clearly see what the reward of the execution will be. So one of the ways that I try to make clear about the reward of catching our own logical fallacies and being more civil with each other is pointing out how abuse and disregard and many of the things that a lot of people don't want to be a part of is actually often dependent on logical fallacies. There's a wheel that we often use in domestic violence training that I've actually found to be useful in all kinds of trainings called the power control wheel. And 1/8 of that wheel is minimization, denial, blame, and distortion. And I really believe that that is really the pathway to abuse in the family, abuse in the education system, and abuse in the leadership management system. And I found that a lot of students tend to respond pretty well to the idea of decreasing critical thinking errors as a way in which to avoid being abusive so that you can be somebody who is actually helpful to themselves and others. So I think part of what you were talking about, Vern, is covered when we become better at linking what we're asking people to execute at an activity level with rewards that are really meaningful to that learner. And I think we've got to keep searching. So if we've got a learner that doesn't seem to be responding to what we're asking them to do, we can't just say, well, that's a bad student, or just sort of move on. We've got to keep searching for what is really rewarding to that person, and how can I link the activities I'm asking them to engage in with what really matters to that person. So those are some examples of some specific things you can do in order to raise the water levels, if you're a leader, an educator, a parent, in order to make it much more likely that people will engage in the activities that are aligned with the vision, and in this case, the vision of better thinking and more stability.
Yellow darkness, my old friend.
Well, I wonder if it makes sense after that pause to toss it on over to Jack, and he can lead us in a discussion on how these fallacies might break down the leadership management system. Jack, does that sound good to you?
Yeah, that's fine. And actually, I hope you guys don't mind. I want to shake it up just a little bit. Because I want to toss in another fallacy and then use it to set the context for what I'm going to talk about here. And I believe there's a fallacy called the labeling fallacy, that when you label something, it colors your perception of that. And I don't know if that's an actual fallacy, but that's the way I think about it. And what I'm getting at is that labeling these as fallacies can limit people. And let me explain what I mean. There is one. I do believe that the credulity fallacy is certainly a fallacy, or incredulity fallacy. So let's set that one aside. But emotion and anecdotes are not necessarily fallacies. They're tools. They're tools that can be used to persuade somebody, to motivate somebody, to get somebody to take action that they would not ordinarily take. And it all depends on how you use the tool to determine whether it's a fallacy or whether it's an actual asset to you. So, for example, if I want to get somebody to change their life in some way, now, bearing in mind that you really can't get anybody to change, they have to want to change and all that, but for people to want to change, you can give them all the logical reasons that they should change. You can show them the dollars and cents. You can show them a nice balance sheet that says these are the benefits and versus the costs of doing this. And people will say, yeah, you're absolutely right, and they won't move. But you need emotion to engage them to move. And let me give you an anecdote that will explain that, because anecdotes tie into this. There's a guy by the name of John Cotter, who is I believe he's a Harvard professor, or he may be retired by now, has done a lot of work on change in organizations. And he tells a story in one of his books of an analyst inside a company had done a lot of research to find that the purchasing system in the company was hopelessly complex, that if they were able to align the purchasing, streamline it, take all the inefficiencies out of it, they could save over $1 billion per year in this company. And he ran that up the chain several times, tried to sell his ideas, and everybody said, yeah, you're right, that's something we should do, and nothing ever happened. What he finally did is he got an intern one summer. He said, go out and buy a pair of gloves that is one pair of every type of glove that is allowed in our system, that's within our system. The guy went out there. It took him a couple of months. He bought 429 pairs of gloves and piled them on top of the boardroom table. And he said the pile was about 3.5 feet high. People walked in and saw this pile of gloves and said, what the hell is that? And he said, that is an indication of how inefficient our purchasing system is. And just it took that to wake people up to say, maybe we should try to figure out how to save $1 billion a year. So,
Jack, that reminds me of some of the research on change from a group of scientists called Prochaska, Norcross, and DiClemente.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the processes that they've identified, they identified 9 major change processes.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done some studies on when these different change processes tend to work in the change process. So, for instance, there's a pre-contemplation stage where people aren't thinking about change at all, and that might fit what you're talking
yep.
about in that scenario. And then there's a contemplation stage where people are kind of thinking about change, but they're not actually doing it. Then there's the preparation stage where people are actually putting together all the different internal and external resources that are needed to change.
Right.
Then there's the action stage, and then there's the maintenance stage. But one of the 9 processes they speak about is the emotional arousal process.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're making me think of. And they have found that that's most it tends to be most impactful during the contemplation and preparation stages. So I just thought I'd throw that out there because you reminded me of the science of this stuff. Yeah.
And so when you're talking about using emotion to help people change or to help people take action, let me give you another example. It's in the book by Chip Heath and Dan Heath. It's called Made to Stick. They call it the Mother Teresa effect. And Mother Teresa supposedly said that if I think of the millions, I won't do anything. But if I think of one person, I will act. And that is because the emotion is involved. And
yes, I think they've done quite a few studies on that as well.
That
you won't act for people or humanity, but if the next door neighbor's kid needs something, you're much more likely to do something. Yeah.
Well, so yeah, and that great motivational expert Joseph Stalin said that that one death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic.
There you go.
So I think the essence of logical fallacy is not about how persuasive it is. In fact, I agree with you that a lot of times system one thinking it can be much more persuasive.
Right.
When we say logical fallacy, what we mean is this has the potential to be wrong without us being aware of it. That's the
exactly.
essence of logical fallacy. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's where I was going with this. I'm not advocating using emotion to sell a bad idea.
Right.
I'm advocating saying you've got to have, and it goes back to what you were saying, Brian, about is it helpful to ourselves and to others? So is the intent there? And does it have a logical, rational, if you will, economic justification and basis? Then to what extent are you justified in using this quote unquote fallacy to get people to even pay attention, number one, and to want to take action?
See, I would not call that a fallacy, the emotional arousal process, because the appeal to emotion fallacy is trying to get people to ignore data and just focus on whether or not somebody's happy, sad, et cetera.
Right.
What you're describing sounds to me more like the emotional arousal process and less like the appeal to emotion fallacy.
I would agree. But and I guess here's where I'm going with this. In an academic setting, when you tell your students these are the fallacies and you go through one each time, do you run the risk of somebody saying, oh, my gosh, I'm never going to tell a story again when I'm trying to convince somebody because that's a fallacy? So people need to know that these aren't necessarily bad. If you've got the proper intent and you've got the rational support for it, and those have to be there, then they are acceptable, even if, quote unquote, they're, you know, you can call them fallacies, you can call it spin, whatever you want to call it, but to what extent are you justified to using spin to sell something that may not sell itself based on the logical merits alone?
See, I
Jack,
hear,
can I say
you
something?
Bring up a really – oh, go ahead, Vern.
Yeah, I was just going to – I've actually coined a, for myself, in terms of what Jack's talking about, I would typically say, and I'll say it to people a lot of times, calling something something does not necessarily make it the thing you're calling it.
Right. Yep.
Just
well,
because
this relate
just because
oh,
you're
sorry,
calling
Ryan,
someone has feels or emotion, there doesn't necessarily mean they're committing the logical fallacy of you know appealing to your emotion. They're using emotion for other reasons. I think that's what you're talking about, Jack.
Yeah, Abraham Lincoln had something to say about that. He said if you something to the extent that if you call a tail a leg, how many legs does a cow have? Oh. And the guy said five, and he said no, it still only has four because calling a tail a leg doesn't make it a leg.
Perfect. And I think that this also relates to that stages of life change model I was referencing, the Prochaska,
yeah.
Norcross, and DiClemente. At the pre-contemplation and contemplation stages, which is where I think people have to be before they recognize what fallacies are and what they are not, there is a process that works pretty well according to the science, and that is called consciousness raising. And I think part of what clarifies things for people is to become conscious of what fallacies are and what they are not.
Right.
So oftentimes students will have certain kinds of reactions like what you just talked about, Jack, is that appeal to anecdotes. They'll say, well, I can't tell a story. And I go, oh, no. Let's get even more specific about what a fallacy actually means. An appeal to an anecdote is when instead of looking at the data, you just tell a story. And that's related
right.
to what Marty had talked about. Instead of looking at the actual data of what changes people from ineffective people to more effective people, you just tell a story of people just being born losers.
Oh, and I understand that. And I think if we are teaching people to be aware of that, you should, if you're in a business setting, which is the only part that I know right now, is that when you hear people telling stories, remember that the plural of anecdote is not data. And you should be suspicious.
Perfect.
Good.
Now, where you can tell a story and still be in the realm of clear thinking and civility is telling a story that helps to get across the actual data.
Exactly.
And that's what you're talking about, Jack, with the gloves and all that stuff. It's not that they're trying to distract people from reality. They've done the research on reality, and now they're trying to emotionally arouse people so that they'll actually move in relation to that reality.
That's
correct.
So I see
those things as very different. So the appeal to emotion would be, hey, don't worry about reality. Let's just all cry and laugh and or be upset at each other. But the emotional arousal process of bringing about change, which is a scientifically sound process, is let's get people emotionally pumped up to live in reality.
I'm 100% on board with that. I just want to touch very quickly on the incredulity one. I think you see this in business more often than you might expect, in a sense that it's kind of like we've never done it this way before.
Mm.
So that's maybe just a maybe milder version of that, but it's really the same classification of fallacy right there. Oh, that'll never work. Well, how do you know? Well, we've never tried it. Well, then how do you know it'll never work?
Perfect. Right.
Yep. And I think people who are higher in the business hierarchy have the power to shut things down by using incredulity.
Sure they do. Mm-hmm.
That might, yep. I'll jump into your realm, Jack, because I do have one foot in it, as I think you know. Is that's one of the top things that when I go in with data-based activities and goals and visions for people who want to change their organization, and I'm imagining you're going to be able to relate to this, that's one of the top barriers I get, is they won't look at the actual data because they don't immediately understand it. And
right.
Then
or don't trust you, Brian.
Oh, good point.
Well, don't trust the data. I don't need them to trust me, but when I bring in all the data, instead of looking it over and thinking about it and wondering whether or not it can actually be applied, whether or not they've done it before, they instead say, well, I don't understand all this data, so it can't work.
But I think also from a communication standpoint, and this is one of the key things that I stress in lean communication, is it's your job to interpret the data for them. You give them the conclusions and then have the data to back it up. Too many people,
right.
Especially people who've taken a lot of pride in collecting all the data, want to show how much work they've done to collect the data. I'm not saying you're doing this, but I've seen a lot of people do this.
Yeah.
And they say, somebody says, hey, is this going to work? And you say, well, that's a great question. Let me tell you about these experiments I did and about the data I collected. And 10 minutes later, they're saying, I still want to know, is this going to work? So
yes.
The best way to do that is to say, yes, it's going to work, and here's the data that backs it up.
Yes, and that's where you've been real influential to me, Jack, over the years, because I think we met somewhere around 15 or 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, I was much more inclined to be the sort of person you're talking about, and that is, let's set aside a whole hour so I can show you all this research, thinking that that was something that would be influential, when in reality I needed to lean that communication up.
And part of that is because of your academic background, you want people to arrive at these conclusions. You want to teach them a way, so you may not actually get the lesson until the end of it. But
yeah, and I wanted them to not have to trust me. I wanted to go in and say, look, I don't matter. Here's 30 years of research on this stuff, and I'll go over it thoroughly. And that's what, you know, my dissertation and master's committee really valued, you know, and so that's where I came from. I think you're exactly right. But I think one of the best parts of keeping one foot in academia and one foot in the business world is that it disabused me of that issue right off the bat. When I say that I want them to be able to look at and trust the data, I don't mean that I want them to sit there for an hour or two
right.
to look it over, but I want them to listen when they say, will this work? I want them to listen to the summary of the data, and then if they still have questions, I want them to read books that
yep.
might answer all their questions if they have them. You know.
And by the way, there's a lot of power to lead with your bottom line, and not even bring up the data until somebody challenges you. And then when they challenge you, and off the top of your head, you give them the answer, you give them the citation or the data to back that up. That's extremely powerful.
Mm.
Nuke them.
Yeah,
you know,
I learned a lot from your mentorship and your articles and your blogs about that, Jack. So I do need to, I guess I'll publicly thank you for that.
Yeah.
Here now.
And that's probably the opposite of the approach that you're taking in an academic setting. So I'm not saying this works every time, but it works very well in a business setting.
The other thing is I realize that our professions alter what we focus on when we think about what works.
Correct.
Maybe. Yeah. So Jack, I think from having read your book, the primary mission is to figure out how a person in sales can actually make the sale by deeply understanding what's going on in the business and what will improve the business. But the goal is to make the sale. And I think it is.
And also so that you understand what the approach that I advocate in bottom line selling is the opposite in a way of what I've just said. In other words, in bottom line selling, I'm not going to go into a potential customer and say, you need to buy this because of X. I'm going to ask the questions and get the customer to arrive at that conclusion so that he or she is motivated to do that. So that's much more in line. That's not the bottom line up front.
Right.
Lean communication, on the other hand, is about effective and efficient communication and getting your point across very quickly and adding value without wasting people's time. So that's the exact opposite.
And that maps on, we've talked about some of the differences between academia and business, but I'd like to talk about one of the commonalities, and that is concise writing and speaking. So when we're writing our articles and we're presenting those articles, there is an emphasis on let's not waste people's time, let's tell people our methodologies, our results, and our discussions in as few words as we possibly can. So I think there's overlap there.
Yep.
Well, Marty, and then say whatever you're going to say is, could you tell us a little bit more about how what Jack has just said really maps onto family too? Because I think what we're talking about is we're engaged in dialogues about logical fallacies and this and that, and fundamentally what maybe works in life and what comes out of this part of the conversation for me is a certain we need to be fluid in our ability to understand what works where, what makes a difference where, and we have different approaches for different environments, as Jack's pointed out, as Brian's pointed out, and you're our family expert.
So what I would do, Vern, I'm glad you sort of recalibrated. So I would draw the distinction between two missions in a family. Mission one is to figure out what is true, and mission two is to get stuff done. And those are both important missions, but sometimes you have to sacrifice one to achieve the other. And so the conversation that Jack was having about the ways that what we're calling logical fallacies when we're in the truth business actually turn out to be very effective influence tools is absolutely true. So I think what we need to do, whether we're in families or whether we're in businesses or whether we're in classrooms, is to figure out what is the prime objective right now? Is it to get things done and have people do things, or is it to figure out what is true and what is not true? Those are both absolutely noble pursuits. We can't live without doing both of them. But I think it's at our peril when we sort of don't carefully analyze what's the core mission here.
So that's and I would add, I think that we also owe it to people, back to this concept of H2O being helpful to ourselves and others, is to be above board when we're playing those two different games.
Yeah.
I know some people that try to influence people to just do what they want by trying to come off like they're truthful. And I think that that is not, in the end, helpful to the self or other people. So to me, it's about being upfront about whether or not you're just trying to get people to comply with what it is you're doing or obey or conform, versus whether or not you're trying to get them to pursue truth. And I believe that this is where all these systems sort of work together, that if people do get really expert or at least pursuing expertise in clear thinking, that eventually what persuades you is truth. Well, Marty, you can speak to this better than I can, the elaboration likelihood model, which is a scientific model of persuasion. And what we find is that people who are good critical thinkers are actually turned off by fallacies or by non-truthful ways that normally influence other people. And so one of the ways in which we can become – oh, go ahead.
There is actually – so this elaboration likelihood model of persuasion actually parallels beautifully Kahneman and Tversky. It is another dual processing model. So what it says is that I'm actually speaking to Vern here because I know that Jack and Brian know these models. So and to our listeners. So what the elaboration likelihood model says is there's a system one way of being persuaded and there's a system two way of being persuaded. And so what Brian is talking about is this system two way of being persuaded. When you're handed a line of drivel and you're highly motivated to get it right and willing to allocate the resources to get to hold the right opinion or attitude, you will tear that thing apart, which you won't do if the stakes are lower or you just don't have the capabilities. You'll just sort of flow along with the system one way of thinking. But here's an interesting wrinkle that ties to our second fallacy, the fallacy of emotion. When people are when we are attempting to persuade people who have a super heavy emotional load on a particular topic, for some people that might be abortion. For some people that might be gun control. For some people that might be too much violence in policing, or it might be inadequate policing, or there are hot button issues in American society that different groups activate very.
I have to throw in climate change, Marty. I have to climate that's change. A big one that perfect. Everyone's arguing about.
I have to throw in anti-vaxxers. I just had this conversation recently.
There you go.
Amen. Mm-hmm. So the point is that for many groups of people, there are topics that are so emotionally loaded and their attitudes are so deeply framed that they do not do what Brian said system two processors do. They engage in what the elaboration likelihood model theorists call biased processing. They've already decided what their position is on climate change or gun control or whatever the topic is, and they're going to beat and wrench and torque the facts into submission. And so when we're engaging with people and we see that they have this super strong affective load on this particular topic or issue, we need to know that these kind of rational system to evidence-based conversations are not likely to change attitudes. And that's because this topic is saturated with very strong emotion.
One of the things I wonder about, Marty, and one of the motivations for me doing this work and doing this podcast with you all is I wonder if we get better at doing what we're talking about on these podcasts in our family systems, education systems, and leadership systems, if that phenomenon would decrease in people. So I'm interested in the degree to which we are actually mentored by our family, by our educators, and by our leaders and managers, whether or not that would decrease the probability that people will just dig in their heels on things that may obviously be untrue to people who aren't digging in their heels.
This actually is part of why I'm so edified by Jack Malcolm's writings, because I think his writings are having exactly that same kind of impact in the business community. It's basically a way of saying, let's not lead with our guts, let's lead with our brains and see where that gets us. And let's engage each other in ways that are civil. That is, ways that are not likely to evoke hostility and hatred and animus against each other. So So I think in the business community, Jack's doing his part. And maybe we need to do exactly the same thing. And I think you mentioned the power and control wheels. Those are tools that were first used in families, I think, to try to achieve the same goal, to try to get families to work better, because we're diminishing the amount of negative emotion that is driving people's behavior and thinking.
And back to some of Jack's writings as well, that I think the theme of this journey into excellence, mapping on to clear thinking and civility, is just a bullseye. So more kudos to Jack about the, I think, clearly communicating in a very lean way some of the most important, I think, maybe the most important thing we could do as mentors and educators and leaders and managers, and that is clear up bad thinking so that we can all be a little more civil to each other. So I think you see, Marty, why I've kept Jack around all these years, huh?
But
one quick thing.
Go ahead.
One quick practical tool. So we were talking about, we wanted to make sure that during these podcasts we gave people really practical advice. And I had a couple of quick things in that regard, and then I want to turn it over to you all to wrap up. But the first one is, keep in mind this little saying to yourself: facts are not feelings. Facts are not feelings. And I think that's a way that you can help this fallacy of feeling be sort of diminished. And then the second thing is, when you're engaging in intense emotional stuff, or when you've decided that you're willing to dismiss what another family member is saying because you're incredulous, the simple piece of advice that can be useful is, take a 10-minute break. When your emotions are getting hot, or when you're starting to pontificate and decide what is true and not true in this family, take a break. Just take 10, 15 minutes, take a walk, go to a different room, explain to people, hey, I'm not being my best self. I'll be back in 10, 15 minutes, and we can engage in a more productive way. So those are two practical things that I think could be helpful with regard to these fallacies with regard to families.
And I would say that those probably generalize across to the education and leadership management systems as well.
Yeah, and I just the last thing that I would leave listeners with is I talked about fallacies versus tools. The important thing is, and Brian, you said it's transparency, but also transparency within your own mind. Because sometimes we want something to be true, therefore we will convince ourselves that we have the facts at our disposal. So remember that intent and that rational logic as well. Be sure you're right, and then you can go ahead and use these as tools.
I'm sure, Jack, you can give us the Feynman quote on that.
Yeah, the most important thing is not to fool yourself, and you're the easiest person to fool.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
You know, and I want to wrap up with something that strikes me as something very powerful in this particular series, and that is, Marty, you're our family guy. Brian, you're our education guy. And Jack, you're our business guy. And what I would say is everything we've talked about here really starts in the family, gets passed on into the educational system, and eventually people in the educational system, our children that come up through that in the enculturation called society, wind up getting passed on to Jack. So that to the extent that there's any breakdown or failure any place along the line or something doesn't work, I don't even want to use the term failure or there's a problem or something to be dealt with, we all need to work together. You know, the families need to ask the educational system if they're getting the students prepared to go in the educational system. The educational system ultimately needs to ask the business system if they're educating students in such a way that they can be productive and they work in a system, a business system that serves us all. Those are just some of my thoughts. And
great insight.
And you guys are
great insight.
It up.
Yeah, no, really, the way I summarize that, as you probably already know, Vern, is H2O. Are we really talking to each other across these systems in evidence-based ways and asking each other the critical question, are we doing the things that are helpful to ourselves and others across these three major systems? So bravo, brilliant insight, and really that's what these podcasts are all about to me.
Jack?
Well, thank you for helping me sharpen some of my ideas, and I've learned a lot already from this podcast, and I really appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
So the listening audience, we do these things once a month. Typically, they're on the first Tuesday of the month. So, folks, it's been my pleasure to be your host here on Journey into Excellence with Dr. Haysacker, Dr. Higley, and Jack. Jack and I are just common folk out here, no doctors and stuff. But
that's right.
But we just be some happy people going down this, going across the oceans of life. As always, thank you guys for inviting me and allowing me to be your host. My name is Vernon Bohr, and we will catch you next month here on Journey into Excellence. There again, I thank my great panel of experts, and tune in next time, folks.